Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by BBC correspondent Peter Bowes. Peter started out in scientific research before moving into broadcasting through local radio. He joined the BBC in 1988, working for Radio 4 on PM, The World at One and the Today programme, before moving to Radio 1, where he worked on The Breakfast Show and presented Newsbeat. He moved to the US in 1996. Based in Los Angeles, he's since covered a huge number of stories for viewers back home and interviewed almost every Hollywood star. He became a US citizen in 2008 and is currently covering the US presidential election. Peter, thank you for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And very kind that you're a bit of a fan of the podcast before you agreed to come on.
I love the podcast, yes. I'm a bit of a media geek, like you are. So I love hearing the stories, and I especially like hearing people that I know and that I've worked with. And Peter Dixon was great. We worked on Steve Wright, of course, together.
He's a legend, isn't he?
Many moons ago. He is a legend. They're both legends.
And Torrin Douglas as well. That was one of the ones you listened to.
Yeah, I mean, the media talk especially. And the insider stuff, of course, the BBC stuff, dealing with stories. And we all have these things in common, how we interact with people and the real world and Hollywood and deadlines and all that kind of thing.
So my first question to you really is an indulgent one, really, which is what is life, like on the West Coast? What's it like dealing with Hollywood celebs?
It's probably like dealing with celebrities here in London. It's not that different. Hollywood, of course, is a huge media factory. As you probably know, it's full of studios. Most of the studios actually not inside Hollywood anymore. There's only Paramount, the last remaining, the oldest Hollywood studio physically within Hollywood. The rest are just outside. But, you know, dealing with celebrities, dealing with the junket circuit that we often have to do, where celebrities sit in front of you for 3 minutes and then move on to the next journalist, it becomes quite mechanical in a way. And that's how celebrities deal with their studios and their managers and people above them manage them. It's a 5:30 start in the morning. It is a factory-like environment. Yes, we're in Los Angeles and the sun shines most of the time, but it's just this entertainment industry, and of course it's much broader than movies and television these days. And, it's thrilling, it's exciting, but once you get down to the nitty-gritty, I suspect it's just the same if you're making a movie or a television show in London or Los Angeles.
So there's a lot of it kind of logistics, like you will get Robert Downey Jr. and you'll have him at 12 minutes past three on Wednesday the 22nd or something, and then if you miss it, you miss it.
Well, they'll say it's 12 minutes past three. It might be 12 minutes past four before he actually arrives, or if it's Cher, she's probably going to be 3 or 4 hours late. That was my experience with her. But yes, I mean, you have your slot. You turn up usually at one of the posh hotels in Beverly Hills, and you do your little interview. If you're lucky, you might get a 30-minute slot, and you might, if you're really lucky, you'll get it outside of the hotel setting or outside of the studio setting. So, for example, I interviewed Glenn Campbell, which is probably the most memorable celebrity interview that I think I've ever done, and spent a day with him.
Wow.
This was just after he'd announced that he was suffering from Alzheimer's, and got to go play golf with him. I don't play golf, but he tried to show me. I was terrible at it, but he was still pretty good.
Good kind of relationship building stuff then.
Excellent relationship building stuff. Went to his home, met his wife, met his family, went to his studio, which is actually a garage studio at the home of a couple of his children, because at that time they were in his band, they were his backing group. And you really get to know, it's only a day, but you really get to know a person, certainly a lot better than that 2.5 minute encounter in a hotel, and it certainly makes a mark on you. So that's the kind of thing I really enjoy doing.
As a journalist, you must kind of try and build up a beat, and is there some kind of midway point between the extremes of spending the whole day with Glenn Campbell and getting 3 minutes with, say, Robert Downey Jr.? Do you have like a list of celebs that you can go to for comment that you have some kind of relationship with?
It's actually very difficult. When something happens that you need celebrity comment, I mean, what we do these days is go to social media, and that has really changed the game. Usually it's a major celebrity death that you want reaction from other well-known people who've perhaps worked with that person. And, previous times you would go to the publicist, and eventually several hours or maybe even a day or two later, you get to that person and do the interview. Now, of course, they just react if they want to react in social media, Facebook, Twitter, whatever they choose. And they don't necessarily feel the need to speak to us. If they've been particularly close to that person, they might not want to sit in front of a camera and share their views, but they're quite happy in a couple of lines or a few words to express their feelings. So that has changed the game in terms of going to celebrities for comment. If you want their reaction to a financial story or some sort of merger story in the entertainment industry, very difficult to get because generally they will speak when the studios want them to talk to promote their next product, their next movie, their next television show. So a go-to list of celebrities, don't really have that.
We had Simon McCoy in that chair a while ago, and he said that, you know, a lot of the job now is when someone dies is they're literally reading out tweets. You know, this person reacted, and that it just comes straight from Twitter.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what we do. I mean, this year, of course, as you know, of all years, has been a particularly tough year in terms of major celebrities dying. Prince, the most recent that I was involved in the coverage, and of course that was a much bigger story than most, largely because of the circumstances. And but it was similar in that people were reacting in social media, and you would go on television, you tried to make the sense of the situation as to how he died and how sudden it was and the logistics of what happened, at the same time as paying respect and reporting on what people were saying. And yes, generally those views come through social media.
And do you have to kind of mirror UK time? Because we've got one client in LA, which basically means we have to stay up very late when we want to deal with them. If you're going to do the 10 or you're going to do breakfast television, that's going to have to play havoc with your body clock.
Yeah, it does. We are on call pretty much 24 hours a day. So breakfast for us is late at night. 10 p.m. is 6 a.m. here in the UK. So if something happens and breakfast weren't alive at the top of every hour, you're up at 10, 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning to do that. And then, of course, it's a big story. It rolls on till later in the day, maybe the 6 or the 10, which is early tomorrow morning, as far as we're concerned, in Los Angeles. So you just got to roll with it. And I mean, luckily, those huge stories don't happen every day. But when they do, Michael Jackson, for example, the death of Michael Jackson, that was a story that went on for weeks and weeks and weeks. But yes, for the first few days, we hardly slept at all because there was something new to say. I mean, it's increasingly a bigger team, people coming into town to help us. But you just go with it. And there's no way around that. I think Los Angeles is probably one of the worst or one of the most difficult time zones. We're minus 8 hours. There's never really a great time. It's either early in the morning, for peak time bulletins here, it's either early in the morning or late at night.
Do you get a sense of the scale of the broadcast in terms of the number of viewers that you're going live to? So if you do the 10 o'clock news, you know, when I've done News Channel, I think, well, there's millions of people watching. But when I've done things at the other side of the world, somehow there's like a slight disconnect and you're almost, it's just a lens at that point. Or are you still aware that you're about to go on the 10 o'clock news?
Yeah, I think certainly with the 10 o'clock news, like with Prince, you are. There's an extra edge to the situation that, you know, you probably have slightly less time. Maybe, OK, Peter, we want you to do this in a minute to wrap up everything you have to say. So you have to be pretty concise and focused. You might get 3 or 4 minutes on the news channel. And it's a more conversational style, of course. It might be a longer two-way. So, I think there's a certain edge to being on the big bulletins. But that said, you're still on the air, whether you're on 5 Live or 1 Extra or the news channel or local radio. It's still a broadcast. People are still listening. And, of course, these days they can listen back. It pretty much, most of it goes onto the internet. So it's not just a one-hit wonder, if you like. You can be heard again. And so you've got to be careful what you say. You've got to try and get it right.
So how does it work in terms of living as a kind of Brit working for a British news organisation, but living in LA? You recently gained, well, say recently, a few years ago, you got US citizenship. So are you aware of a kind of duality there? How does it work?
You are, and, you know, I mean, I'm always British and still British. I still got a British passport as well as an American passport, and, you know, was born in this country, was born in Sedgefield in the northeast of England, and you still have family here, still have lots of friends here, and visit the UK a lot. So you never lose that. But I think you become Americanized to a point. I haven't acquired the accent. Everyone remarks on that, which some people from Britain do pretty quickly. But I haven't gone down that road. But you make yourself understood. You adopt the lifestyle to a certain extent to get through the day, to as I say, to make people understand what you're all about. But your brain is kind of split. It's kind of a split personality thing that you go into British mode when you need to, and you're more American if the situation calls for it.
And does being British open up a lot of doors for you? Do people like, oh, you're a Brit, that's great?
It does a little bit. Certainly the BBC opens doors. You say you're from the BBC, you'd like to speak to so-and-so, you'd like comment about whatever, you'd like to do an interview. And people, many people are still in awe of, and quite rightly, in awe of the BBC. It certainly carries across America. And of course, with the internet, people are much more aware of the BBC. There was a time, and certainly when I first went to Los Angeles 20 years ago, some people, and even publicists for major studios, would say, the what? What's the BBC? I mean, you
wow,
look surprised.
Then.
But even then, people would say, and publicists for major institutions, universities, that kind of thing, weren't as aware of the BBC then, certainly, as they are now. And yeah, it certainly helps to open doors. And I think that the whole British thing, well, Americans always say, you must be intelligent then. Oh, yeah, this old accent of ours makes us sound more intelligent than, certainly in my case, I really am. That helps.
Well, I think you're a reasonably intelligent bloke, Peter. How did you end up in America then? I mean, because clearly you had you were working on Newsbeat, you did Radio 4 and Radio 2 as well, as you mentioned earlier. You had a big career here as a BBC broadcast in the UK. Did someone email you or, I imagine, phone you back then and said, hey, Peter, do you want to go to LA? How did it happen?
Not quite like that. As you say, my last big job in the UK was working on The Breakfast Show with Steve Wright. And I did that a little bit with Simon Mayo towards the end of his run. I was reading the news, just reading the news really with Simon. But then, of course, with Steve Wright, you were part of the whole posse and you were much more of an integral part of the show. We did road shows together, which for a news
the
journalist
Radio 1 road show.
A little
wow.
Surreal.
Amazing.
Yeah, on the South Coast.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, it was a lot of fun. And
it still is a lot of fun. I mean, he's not changed the formula. I still listen to it on Radio 2 in the afternoon. It's still a good show.
It's still a great show. I'm still on it sometimes. We usually cover the Oscars together, and it is so I know the shtick, I know the formula, and as you know, he pre-records most of those interviews, and for good reason. It makes for a much slicker sort of final edit, I think, and ultimately that's what it's all about, to make it sound good on the air. And Steve knows me, I know him, I know what he wants, and he's a great presenter as well as producer of that segment and of the show. So that's what I was doing in 94. Steve finished on The Breakfast Show. And generally what happened then, I think it still happens today, is that the presenter finishes, everyone finishes, newsreader finishes, and everyone moves on to something else. So I'd been working for Radio 1 since 1990. At that point, I'd been presenting Newsbeat before that, as you say, the Today programme, other Radio 4 programmes. And it just came to that point where I thought, well, let's do something different. And we on The Breakfast Show had sometimes a few problems getting good, solid entertainment coverage out of Los Angeles. There was a BBC correspondent there who didn't necessarily do, not his fault, it's just it wasn't his job, a lot of entertainment. And I just kind of saw a little niche there that I quite like to get into. I'd been to Los Angeles a couple of times to cover the aftermath to the riots, the Los Angeles riots, Rodney King riots, sometimes referred to as. And, of course, this is not long after the earthquake in Los Angeles as well, covered a bit of that. And I covered the end of the O.J. Simpson trial in 95. And it was during that time I began thinking about LA as a possible place to live and work, had a little scout around, and thought, yeah, this could work. And
yeah, because I used to watch you and Vivian Krieger over on Sky News. She used to anchor all the OJ coverage.
Right.
There. It was nightly. Do you remember? It was like 3 hours of a night covering the OJ trial.
Oh,
it's unbelievable.
It was amazing. And yeah, I to this day remember the final day of that trial standing. I was actually outside the court in the crowd. I mean, a huge, vast crowd downtown Los Angeles waiting for the verdict to come in. And of course, it was a very, very quick verdict, which surprised.
Yeah, the jury were only out for about an hour.
About 4 hours.
Oh, yeah, it was momentary, though.
It was momentary. And it was enough to make people think, well, could they really consider all of that evidence, a year's worth of evidence in 4 hours? But they had made up their minds, now famously, of course, that he was not guilty. And
incredible.
It was amazing, still looking back. And it's a story that isn't over.
I watched all the recent reenactment of it all.
Yeah, which is really good.
And a lot of the jurors have spoken since, and I can see it from their point of view. The prosecution just didn't accept that once the jury concluded Mark Furman was a liar and had planted evidence before, then they thought, well, there's reasonable doubt there.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was a verdict that surprised everyone. Then, of course, there was the civil trial, and he was found liable for the deaths during that civil trial. But no jail time with that. But events moved on, and he was eventually found guilty of something completely unrelated, a bizarre crime, essentially in a hotel in Las Vegas.
He's going to retrieve what he considered his medals or something, or his, I don't know what they were.
His sporting memorabilia, yeah.
It's insane. They clearly thought he was a wrong un and tried to get him on something else.
Yeah, I mean, they, I'm sure, would deny that, but you can only imagine what was going through the minds of the jurors and indeed the judge on that trial. So yeah, I mean, he is still in jail to this day. He's coming up for parole. He could potentially be released at some point
in
the future.
Frankly,
well, You can say that I possibly couldn't comment. But yeah, so it's a story that isn't over. So all of that, that background to Los Angeles, thought, yeah, this is a great place to be. Managed to persuade Radio 1, and I was already freelance, but kind of full-time contract freelance as a presenter reporter at Radio 1. So they gave me a freelance contract.
So that gave you a bit more freedom to actually suggest that then. Had you been fully on staff, as it were, there would have been layers of BBC bureaucracy to go through.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. And it probably wouldn't have worked out this way, that I could essentially go to Los Angeles as a freelance with a very sort of minimal guarantee of some work. But then it was up to me to make it work. And, I mean, luckily it did, and didn't just work for Radio 1, work for a lot, and still do for Five Live, and you know, as more of the online outlets came on board, and then there's Radio 4 and there's television as well. So there's a lot to go at.
So you've never been short of work?
Thankfully not. And I'm incredibly lucky in that respect, that I haven't been short of work. It's a great place to be, of course. There's always something happening. It's not just Los Angeles, it's the west coast of America.
Love LA. Love the west coast.
Yeah.
It's, so it's... jealous. You've got the best job in the BBC, other than Director General, I would say.
I wouldn't want that job, would you?
Well, I'd probably take yours over his, actually. Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Okay.
Clearly, I think I've done you a slight disservice by asking you about Hollywood from the outset, because your beat is much wider than that, isn't it? It isn't just merely Hollywood. You're there to cover everything that happens on the West Coast.
Yeah, exactly. And in that sense, there isn't a geographical beat, but there isn't a subject beat. So I don't focus just on Hollywood. I particularly enjoy doing science stories, health stories. I'm really interested, fascinated by human longevity, and I've made a couple of documentaries. I'm interested in diet and exercise and all those good LA-type things that go into that.
So, I'm a vegan and a teetotaler. I would, I'd do well in LA, wouldn't
I? You'd love it. Yes, you wouldn't be short of new restaurants, which, you know, sometimes coming or travelling outside of Los Angeles is a bit of a struggle, but certainly on the vegan side, you do great. Teetotal, well, you can be teetotal anywhere, I suppose.
But they're into that health, aren't they? I mean, and that's interesting. Have you developed this interest in longevity and health since you moved to LA? Because, you know, it might be a kind of generalisation, a bit kind of cliche, but they are quite health conscious in LA, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, some to a sort of lunatic level, but others, I think, quite sensibly. And I've been looking at some of the research from USC, University of Southern California, and looking at diet research. And I mean, it's a long, sort of complicated story, but looking at the comparison that has been made between a group of people in Ecuador have something called Laron syndrome, that they lack a certain growth hormone that seems to make them protected, not necessarily 100% immune, but certainly protected from cancer and diabetes. This is a genetic defect. USC are looking at a diet, which is largely a fasting diet, a periodic fasting diet, that also causes a drop in that hormone that could possibly long-term protect people. And it's certainly been proven in mice, rats, other organisms, it could protect you and I from cancer.
Lots of people
diabetes.
Do the fasting thing. I mean, I do it two days a week, the whole Michael Mosley
thing.
Fewer than 600 calories on your fasting day.
Right, yeah. This is similar. It's more of a periodic diet, and it's five fasting days consecutively. So it's five of those, you know, the 2 days out of the seven for the 5 2-days, it's five of those back to back. So you're having 5 days of maybe 700 calories, which is doable. It's absolutely doable. And it certainly puts you into this state where if you continue it long term, and that's what I'm experimenting with myself, it could protect you from cancer. So that's at the serious end of science. This isn't loony LA. This is you know, serious science, which is interesting.
Quite a breadth of subjects there, haven't you? Right from, like you say, science, human longevity type stuff, to then interviewing Hollywood stars.
Yeah, I love it, and I'm privileged to do that. And I think largely because I am, to some extent, my own boss, and I can pick and choose stories a little bit. I would never say no to a news story, because they happen and you do it. But in terms of the features, I've become more particular over the years as to what I want to do, and this area interests me, so I go ahead and do it.
So on the pie chart of what you proactively generate in terms of stories and then stuff you react to, people dying, earthquakes or whatever, how does that work? What's a typical week for you? How much of it is planned where you think, right, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and then so much of it is like Prince dies, for example, and then all bets are off, you've got 23 inquiries coming through from London and you need to deal with them?
Usually what happens if you have a well-planned week, your feature week, your documentary week, you're travelling to X, Y, and Z, you're travelling to San Diego, San Francisco to do these big interviews you've been working on for ages to secure, and something happens. So there's a news story, you can't ignore it, you've got to do it, you've got to make a quick round of calls to cancel everything organised. It doesn't happen every week, but it does happen quite a lot. So in that respect, there isn't a typical week. You try to fit in the features when you can and make time for them. And you know, if they are so crucially important, you still go ahead and do it and someone else will cover the news. But a typical week might involve covering, let's say, a middle-ranking news story that doesn't absorb you completely for the entire week. In the morning, and then in the afternoon, you might go off and do a feature-related interview or edit something.
Because then the time zone benefits you, doesn't it? Because where is sleep when you can get your productive time in?
Yeah, exactly. So the busy news times are in the morning till 10 or 11 o'clock. Well, let's say till 2 o'clock in the afternoon, that's 10 p.m. here. Then there's a bit of a lull, nighttime. Well, there's still plenty of nighttime outlets, and I often do overnight world television interviews, that kind of thing. But you know, if you manage your time, you can try to fit in other things around it. But you can't predict. You can't stop those news stories happening. So you've just got to be ultimately very, very flexible.
Just in terms of the lifestyle of how it works, one of the other things I'm interested in is how you in effect stay British. How do you keep up to date with? I mean, because it's an issue for you. You work for a British broadcaster and you're broadcasting to British people. So how do you know what's happening? How do you know who's won the X Factor or you know who the government of the day is? And how do you also know who the presenters are? Because you know, do you get asked to do a show and then you have no idea who this person is or where they've come from, and yet they're presenting the 6 o'clock news.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes that'll happen at short notice, and you don't know the presenter. You just avoid saying their name. That's all you do. You just get on and do the interview. But you stay in touch. I mean, it's much easier to stay in touch now as it was 20 years ago. I can read multiple websites and find out what's happening in the news. There are things that interest me, particularly that are happening in the UK. I follow UK politics still. You've got to know, because you don't know whenever something that's going to happen in London is going to impinge on American coverage. That they overlap more often than you would think. So you just make sure that you're well read into British and American stories, and you try to stay across the culture. Of course, you've got friends here, I've got family here. I come here to visit quite a lot. So you do stay in touch, and it's almost instinctive. I don't really have to make the effort to do that because I want to know what's happening.
Yeah, that kind of natural curiosity back to your homeland. Yeah. But is there a system? I mean, do you read the Telegraph Leader every day, or do you kind of what is the system to stay in touch?
The system is to read as much as I can. I don't have I'll read the Telegraph and then the Guardian and the BBC website in that order. I usually pick and choose stories, and I think like all of us these days, you dot around a lot. So you might be on the BBC website, but then you'll see a link to something that's outside of the BBC website, and off you go to the Guardian or whatever it is, or to the LA Times, and you just absorb information from everywhere. I think that one of the big things that, and I was just waiting to speak to you, I was reading The Sun in paper. You know, I don't read paper coverage anymore, newspapers, and that's a big difference. And I notice when I come back to the UK, more people still read newspapers. At least it seems like that certainly in the office in Los Angeles, we don't get any papers anymore. It's all online. And I kind of miss that, and I don't miss the cumbersome aspect of broadsheets anymore. But then there's a sort of nostalgic factor there that, you know, on a Sunday, I still like reading the papers in this country.
Do you read I don't know what the name of the local paper for Sedgefield is, but do you read that? I mean, I'm from York originally. I've not lived there for many, many years. I live in London. Now I work in London, I should say. But, I do still read the York paper online. And if not every day, most days.
Yeah, it's the Northern Echo.
The Northern Echo,
it doesn't just cover Sedgefield, of course. It's a vast regional newspaper. I don't read it every day, but I do dip into it, yes. And I know one or two people who work there, and I've talked to them, and they've quoted me on a few stories. There was a great story recently. They were trying to. I was born in Sedgefield at a hospital that is no longer a hospital, it's now a hotel.
And typical.
Yeah, typical. And they were looking back and trying to figure out who was the last person to be born at the hospital. And it was, I think it was late 1960s. And I just happened to be reading it online one day and spotted this and just mentioned it to the person I work there. I know who works there. And so, of course, they asked me about my story, and they quoted me and my mum's experiences at that particular hospital. So it's nice to stay in touch like that.
Final question before we start to talk about US politics and some of the other stuff that you cover, which is quite interesting, is how does it work logistically in terms of the BBC requesting you? Because you're a freelancer, aren't you? So do you get, if something happens, you'll get 30 inbound inquiries. Do you have to log them and then charge separately for them? Or do you, I mean, I don't need to disclose your salary, of course, but is it like you get a fixed amount of money and then you're just there whenever you need it?
Or? You were right in the first instance. It's pretty much logging everything I do and charging for it. And I'm not that unusual in that respect. There are plenty of people like me around the world for the BBC who work in exactly the same way, in places, far-flung places, that there isn't necessarily a staff person, although there is a staff reporter in Los Angeles as well.
But you can't bill BBC Three Counties Radio for 6 minutes on a Wednesday, can you? Is there a spreadsheet?
There is a spreadsheet, yes. I mean, there's a rate card. Essentially, it's similar to any other sort of freelance rate card, that according to what you've done and who you've done it for and how long it is, or how many days you spent doing it. Every story is slightly different. So there is a... It's not like I make it up as I go along. Oh, I'll charge this for that, and depending on which outlet it is. It would be fantastic, wouldn't it? But it's not like that. So there's a rate card, and you just stick to the rate card.
Is there... Oh, last question then, because I am a kind of media geek. Is there a hierarchy, even if it's not official in your mind, like the 6 and the 10 is top, and then maybe the World Tonight and PM, the Today programme, and then you get slightly further... You know, Jeremy Vineshaw, I imagine, will be fairly high up. But then you might get to the more local shows that are slightly further down the list. And you do have to prioritise.
I'd love to be on the Jeremy Vine show, but it's, I think, 3 o'clock in the morning for me. So he's on at 11 o'clock, is that right?
12 to 2.
OK, so...
I say that because it's the show I go on the most, actually.
There you go. Well, drop in a word. Now, I would get up early for that, but it's 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
There is a hierarchy in terms... I mean, obviously, the 10 is very important. And the Today programme on Radio 4, which I do quite a lot of, is late at night for me. But you generally don't get to pick and choose. The story happens, and whichever programmes are on the air in the window that the story breaks, you will do first. And then later in the day, if it's one of those big stories, it overlaps into the next day, well, you'll maybe stay up late and do breakfast and the Today programme. But I don't pick and choose. It's not really up to me. I'm asked to do stories. I don't say, oh, I'd like to do this, but only for the Today programme because I like that, and not for this show. You don't pick and choose like that. You just cover for all of the BBC.
But you are literally one person. So if Five Live want you at just after eight and so do the Today programme, you have to be able to at least say to one of the producers and schedule it in. I often think of it, because you're one of the people I think is a tiny bit like the Prime Minister, and I mean this like a compliment, that when he's got a big announcement, he does the Today programme, then he does Good Morning Britain, and then BBC Breakfast, then Sky News, then he's on Five Live. And you can tell, I mean, he's only one person, but you can tell he's had that kind of 20 minutes of live media very carefully choreographed. And if you've got a big story, you're the man in situ. You do have to do a bit of management.
You do a little bit of management, yes. And if it's a huge story, it's not just me, of course, in Los Angeles. There's James Cook, who is the Los Angeles staff correspondent. A great guy, excellent reporter. He will do a lot of the big coverage as well. And he will generally do those big set piece items, the package that goes on to the 10, or maybe the package for the Today programme, whatever the story requires. And I'm doing, maybe we might both be on the same programme. The Today programme might want a live two-way in the first 30 minutes, and then they might follow it up with a package later in the morning. So we're both working on the same show, and it's often split, and we're getting into those sort of geeky areas again, but it could be split between person doing the packaging job and the person doing the live and continuous job, where you're just bouncing from one live outlet to the next one. Mixing the two is quite difficult because producing a package takes much more time. You're trying to craft a script, and jumping out of that to do the live can be a little problematic. So,
which do you prefer?
I enjoy doing the lives. I enjoy the adrenaline of being live, of telling the story, not quite knowing what you're going to be asked by the presenter. Generally, most presenters on those kind of breaking stories will ask the same question. So you're trying to give the same answer but make it a little bit different according to the outlet. So I really enjoy that. If I'm doing the packaging, it's a different discipline, and perhaps ultimately you've got something there you can go back to and look at, and a nicely, finely crafted piece is something that you can look back on and say, well, yeah, there's a good job done. But so they both have an appeal. But I think if I had to choose between the two, I enjoy the the going live bit.
Do you get recognised in America for your work with the BBC? I mean, clearly people might recognise you here, people like me that follow the BBC's work and follow your work. You get recognised walking down the streets of London, as it were. But do you ever get recognised in LA by your LA friends?
I've never been recognised in the streets of London.
Have you not, right?
Never mind Los Angeles.
Right.
No is the answer.
Right.
I've never been recognised. And, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, yes, I think I know your name. You know, and maybe they say your voice, but I don't always necessarily believe that. I mean, BBC can be seen and heard, as you know, in America. Public television, public radio uses different strands of the BBC.
I play a radio app, works in America. When I'm there, I still listen to the show.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so there's two ways you can listen to the, obviously using the iPlayer, but also some of the public outlets will carry the BBC on
NPR
their
and things like
airwaves,
that.
NPR especially, and public television as well, at certain times of the day. So people will, avid viewers of those outlets, might recognise you because they prick up their ears when they hear a Los Angeles story on their local station, but covered by the BBC. So they might know you from that. But no, it's actually quite nice to be anonymous.
Is there a particular challenge when you're covering an English-speaking foreign country like America, where I've done this before, where there's a bit of culture shock? You go there and you think that they're exactly the same as us, and they're not. You know, if you were the correspondent in Paris, we would understand it's a foreign country, but do you have to have a little bit of nuance in your reports to say that things are slightly different there? How do you carry that across?
Well, yes and no. I mean, certainly America is different, and Americans' understanding of some of the everyday things that you and I would talk about, it can be a little bit challenging. And if I'm generally broadcasting to a British audience. I mean, yes, sometimes I'm on BBC World, which is a global audience. It's not specifically most times of the day for an American audience. And there's World News America, which is part of BBC World, which is broadcast at certain times of the day on cable in the United States. But you've got to think that you're doing that alongside doing it for a global audience as well. So my mind isn't focused on the American audience. It's more focused on a global audience. And sometimes the language that you use, and it's the same with the World Service, you might have to simplify things a little. You don't use too much jargon, colloquial language. You try to keep it simple to the facts. And that almost sounds a little condescending, but you see what I mean? You don't use phrases that would only be understood in the West End of London or, in certain geographical areas.
Well, have you picked up any LA-based phrases, stuff that you would use, phrases, idioms that you would use over there with your LA friends that you have to consciously not say? Like, I'm a Yorkshireman, I would never say A up. I might have said now then a few years ago, but given that was Jimmy Savile's catchphrase, you never say that again.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's all the obvious ones. It's, you stand in line in America, you don't queue for something. Mm. But I think increasingly...
They got Obama on that recently, didn't they, with the Brexit speech?
Exactly, yeah. But I think increasingly Americans do get it. Again, thanks to the internet, people are much more aware of other nations' ways of doing things. And I think, by and large, you can get away with most things in America and be understood. I mean, as I say, certain little turns of phrase that you would maybe think twice about. Can I get a sandwich? I would like a sandwich. Little things like that, the use of certain words that maybe 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I was more aware of. Actually, these days, it doesn't really matter so much.
Is Trump a godsend to you as a journalist, or does it worry you? I mean, do you see it as a story like any other?
It's certainly a godsend, yeah, because it's a great, unpredictable story. I've been covering American elections since, actually, before I moved to the US. 1992 was the first year of convention coverage for me. I went to Houston to cover the Republicans that year. This is when George Bush Sr. was trying to be re-elected, and it was the year that Bill Clinton was elected. I, as part of that trip, actually managed to doorstep Bill Clinton outside the Los Angeles Times.
What was he like?
He was great. I think, a little surprised. It was one of those impromptu moments. He was actually there to do, as they often do, an interview. I think it was with the editorial board of the Los Angeles Times. It wasn't a big press event. I was just, I'd been there covering some other things and just happened to be walking past the building and saw, obviously the car stop and the Secret Service come out. And out gets Bill Clinton. And there was just a fairly small crowd. There weren't many media there, and just happened to have my radio kit with me, just push myself to the front, push the microphone in. A few bristled, Secret Service people at the time, but they let me ask a few questions.
So it was just the candidate at this point, of course. You can't say Mr. President.
Absolutely, he was just the candidate. Yes, and you know, he'd been having a tough time during that campaign, but he was doing all right. I think he knew that he was on the up. It wasn't, you know, it was a very unpredictable election, as everyone knows. But I got a sense from his demeanour that he was pretty confident.
I met Bill Clinton for about 20 seconds once in Blackpool. Him and Kevin Spacey, bizarrely. And I was introduced to him by name, and then he was introduced to another five or six people. And then he came to me and he said, "So, Paul, how's it going?" And then he'd held on to my name for 20 seconds.
Impressive.
And that was the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever been starstruck by anyone else?
Oh, you know, the more I do this, and a lot of people say this, the less starstruck you become. There are not that many people, really, that you walk into the room and, you know, starstruck, speechless, whatever. Yeah, I think I mentioned Cher a little earlier. She was, you know, when you sort of interview these icons who you've watched for years and you're suddenly in the same room together, there is a little moment you think, my goodness, that really is her. And, you know, she was amazing. It was just, hello, Cher. Hello, dear. And that kind
amazing.
Of set the tone. And she was very, very late. But she was, and it was one of those, quite a long interview, 20 minutes I got with her. And she was great and chatty and honest. I mean, I think it's the interviewees that are honest. And you can tell they're being honest and not just putting on a show for the camera, that I like a lot. I mean, Harrison Ford earlier this year, a very different character. Maybe not quite starstruck, but he's still Harrison Ford.
It's Harrison
for goodness
Ford.
Sake. Yeah, exactly.
The Fugitive was his best film. I still love that film.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, we were talking about Star Wars mostly. And he's, I don't think he likes being interviewed. He's pretty stoic in terms of his answers, fairly short answers, not particularly colourful. And, you know, he doesn't get particularly emotional about things. So, you know, I asked him which of his characters was the favourite that, you know, he performed.
It's an obvious question, but it's the one you want to ask, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's the one
yeah.
you want to answer. He didn't have any favourites.
I don't have favourites. I don't have favourite children. I don't have favourite foods or whatever his answer was. It was just quite a stoic, you know, fairly tedious answer. But that's him. That's the guy. He was charming. Otherwise, he was great.
I mean, I've done quite a few of these podcasts as well, and I prefer interviewees like yourself, that where you just kind of ask a question and then they go off on one and they conduct the interview themselves, really. It's always difficult when people answer kind of closed, short answers that you constantly have to think of new things to think about. Because really, you know, my question at the beginning was, what's life like in America? I mean, we're still talking about that now, really.
We could. I mean, the best interviews are interviews that are conversations and that you can go off at these tangents. I prefer not to have a list of questions in front of me. I will have a few notes, usually, of bullet points that I want to hit.
I have bullet points in front of me, as you can see.
Much the same as yourself. And then be prepared to go off at a tangent. And clearly, interviews are different. If it's a news interview, there are certain areas that you really have to cover, certain questions that have to be asked. But then if it's a more, you know, a larger scope to the interview, a celebrity interview, and you can leave room for the anecdotes and the stories that you don't expect, I think that's what makes a great interview. I mean, oftentimes, I will see people, especially celebrity interviews, they do have their key questions. And it's as if they're not listening to the answer previously and they'll just go straight on to the next question.
I think that's difficult.
Which is awful. And sometimes, you know, you've got to be careful in the edit that you don't... you can make a good interview not a good interview by not listening to what's actually being said in the edit, and you leave something out that kind of explains what's just gone. So it's not just the doing of the interview, it's the editing of the interview as well.
And do you find that there's some pressure from, like, beastly PR people like me that might sit in the room and agree in advance what you can and can't say? Because there's always a tension there.
There is. And, I mean, generally, I haven't had too many problems. I mean, a few occasions when the PR person has said you cannot ask about X, Y and Z, and sometimes you pretend not to hear them and you go ahead and you ask the questions anyway. And to my surprise, sometimes the interviewee, the celebrity, will just go ahead and answer. They don't really care. They're not even aware sometimes that the publicist has asked you not to ask the question. Mm. They are blissfully unaware and are almost expecting that difficult question, that awkward question that, you know, in the back of their mind they know they might have to answer, and they've got an answer. Sometimes if it's a controversy, Sly Stallone, for example, this is quite a few years ago, he was involved in a sort of minor drug controversy.
He was trying to bring steroids into Australia, wasn't he?
Exactly, yes. And I just happened to be interviewing him the next week about whatever project it was at the time.
It was Rocky Balboa at the time.
You've got a better memory than me.
I just love the Rocky films.
Yeah, exactly. So I wasn't told not to ask about it, but there were lots and lots of publicists around that day. I mean, in the room very close to where we were sitting.
It's kind of physically intimidating a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, it is. They're more, you know, Sly was less intimidating than they are. And so I had to ask the question about what he'd been doing and what his response was, and exactly. And as soon as I asked the question, the publicist, I mean, stepped in, right in front of the camera, as if to say, no, and hands up, no, you can't. And he said, to his credit, no, it's okay, and kind of ushered them away. Go ahead, ask your question. I asked the question, and it gave a perfectly good answer. He wanted to address the issue. And I find that a lot of times that people actually do want to talk. They don't need necessarily protecting from the media.
It's interesting because I am one of those beastly PR people and I would never do that. But I think there's two reasons why it might happen. One is they're trying to justify their fee. They think that, you journalist type shouldn't be asking that. So they're going to try and do it because they mistakenly believe it's in their client's interest. Or they want the client to have deniability, where that's why they've never raised it with Sylvester Stallone, because, as you could see in his eyes, he hadn't instructed his PR people, but they were just playing safe on his behalf.
Yeah, exactly. And what I don't see, and what you're probably more aware of, is the relationship between the celebrity and the publicist and what is said in the room before you walk in, and that conversation about the scope of the interview and what can be asked, what can't be asked, what sort of arrangements have been made, what sort of pressure is on the... And clearly there is, I mean, you'll know better than me, but what sort of pressure is on the publicist to rein in the journalists, if that is the role. I mean, I'm blissfully unaware of that side of things, thankfully, and just go in and do the interview. But I am well aware that it is a bigger game, if you like, between all of the people involved. It's not just the publicists in the room. Sometimes, when very often, I'm going into an interview that's been arranged by a publicist in the UK because it's for the UK market, but it's the publicists in the US who are actually masterminding it on the day, and there have been clearly conversations between those publicists and their counterparts in the UK. They might have reached certain agreements. You've got to make sure that journalist doesn't ask this, this and this, and they can only have 4 minutes or whatever the deal is. So it's a big jigsaw of lots of people involved, lots of vested interests involved, and maybe lots of jobs involved as well.
I always find the Hollywood media machine fascinating because, you know, if I had a teapot manufacturer that I was trying to PR, I couldn't get the managing director on the Graham Norton show. And yet, because it might be human nature, of course, that we want to hear from the latest Superman actor and Steven Spielberg and so on, but there seems to be an open door for any Hollywood celeb to kind of get in the media because we're interested in it in a way that we're not in other sectors.
Yeah, I mean, Hollywood celebrity, it drives interest. And you just got to look at websites. You know, you have a major celebrity saying something, doing something. Generally, if it's not promoting the film and it's about something else, and if there's a certain misfortune aspect to the story, well, people look at it even more. I mean, celebrity sells big time, and whether they are promoting themselves or something else that they are maybe even being paid to publicise, that's the name of the game these days.
It's bizarre, though, because celebrities are selling something. They're a business like any other, whether it be a film or their latest vitamin tablet or whatever. You've got to balance that, haven't you? And that might be a particular challenge for you as an LA-based correspondent, really, because people are going to be interested in the package anyway because you've got Sylvester Stallone there, but you've also got to tease out of him why he brought those steroids into Australia.
Yeah, exactly. And especially if the celebrity, and that was a situation where he was involved in a news story as well as publicising something. Sometimes it is a pure publicity event and it's a star promoting his next movie. So the challenge for me is how to make this interview really interesting, to bring something else to it, to try to tease out of the celebrity a story that's nothing to do with the film. And sometimes that's very challenging because they don't want to go down that road. The publicity machinery around them has instilled in them that they talk about the character and how great the director is, which to me is usually pretty dull.
It's boring, as a viewer and a listener, I think that. I know they think their colleagues were great and the director had vision. You know, tell us about the drugs.
Exactly. They're always going to think about that. So, and sometimes there isn't another story. There isn't always a drug story to get into. There isn't always a marriage breakup or whatever scandal du jour. So you've just got to try to tease something out about themselves, maybe something about their own personality that they brought to the film. Maybe there's a little story there you could bring out of them. every interview is different and you don't often know till you get into it. The huge frustration for me doing these things, especially these junket scenarios, is the lack of time to develop. We've been talking for a long time, which is great.
It's been great so far.
Thank you. It's been fun. But you'll get 2.5 minutes. There's not much you can do in 2.5 minutes. You need to sort of ease into it to warm up the celebrity and then get into the real, you know, meat of the story.
Particularly because the first two questions are going to have to be what you would consider the obvious ones, like what was it like to play Han Solo again?
Yeah, exactly. There are certain obvious questions you've got to ask. I mean, as a little anecdote there, reminds me of sort of red carpet situations, which, again, are very different. And you might get a minute as the person walks past you, and they are answering the same question from every journalist from every country along that red carpet. And I've known a couple of times celebrities get irritated, and they should know, but they get irritated because they're being asked the same question. And on one occasion, someone, I can't even remember who it was, he said, "Well, I've just answered that to that guy down there." Well, that was fine for him, but it didn't go
CNN.
Into my microphone.
Yeah, exactly,
it didn't
go
into my camera, so I need it again from you. And they should know that.
Do you get blacklisted? Do you get trouble? I mean, we've had John Sweeney sitting in that chair, and he's had some terrible trouble with the Scientologists, most of which he's brought on himself. He loves bashing them. But do you get that kind of thing where people say, right, you weren't very good with Sylvester Stallone then, so you're on our blacklist now, you're never getting Sly again?
If it's happened to me, I'm not aware of it. There's always that sort of subliminal threat of being not invited back again if you overstep the line. I don't think it's happened to me, and generally, and for good reason, there are rules, and you know, you've got to behave yourself on a red carpet, and I don't believe in sort of overstepping the mark for the sake of doing it. And I think you've got to show respect to the people that you're interviewing as well. So I'm not aware of any sort of blacklist situation with me. I think I would know about it if it had happened. But I think as long as you show due reverence to the person that you're interviewing and the subject and the scenario and the situation, after all, you're invited to be there and you're there for a reason. And I think, you know, you both got to kind of play the game to some extent.
So tell me, what's next for you? I mean, you've been doing this now for, is it 20 years? Do you want to do it for another 20 years? Or are you going to go into space or Antarctica? What are you going to cover?
Well, doing it in Los Angeles for 20 years and much longer, of course, in local radio before I even joined the BBC, and we haven't had time to talk about working in, you know, radio.
This should be a two-hour podcast.
We should have
it?
A sequel, definitely, yeah.
We will.
But yeah,
early years.
Indeed, the radio teasers and all of that, which was great fun. What's next? I would like to continue doing what I'm doing. I'd like to do more of my little passion project, and that is the longevity story, which is a big story. It's linked to the obesity crisis around the world and the science that.
Tell us about it. How did you get into it?
I've always been a runner. I enjoy exercise. I'm a pescatarian. I'm not quite a vegan, but over the last few years, I've come to understand.
You're a vegetarian.
Something like that. Yes, that it's a healthier way of life. And I know this is hugely controversial to a lot of people, but I don't believe necessarily that eating too much protein in the form of red meat, basically, is a good way to live. I think that the science is, it's a little bit like climate change, that there's always going to be someone who will argue with you, quite rightly. But, you know, that's the way I'm thinking. And I'd like to continue to see that debate through and look at whatever the science tells us, and certainly follow this particular project that I'm looking at, the Ecuadorian dwarfs, and what we can learn from them in terms of diet and, you know, perhaps prevention of cancer and that kind of thing. So I think that's a hugely fascinating area. I'd like to do more documentaries. There might be a book in that as well. So there's a lot to go at.
So what advice would you give to someone who wants to be the next you, who's just starting out in their media career?
I would say be open-minded, be interested. I mean, if I'm talking to students, I always say, I mean, I think you started this interview by saying I started in science, and I did. I started in science. I was interested in that area. I was interested in medicine and health and animals, and I thought that's what my career had in store for me. I was also interested in radio and television. The two were competing for a while and eventually went to the radio and television side. But I've always been interested in science and continue to draw upon that knowledge and that experience working in medical research for a while in this country. And so I would say, you know, you might be 19 years old, 21 years old at university, pursue your geography degree, pursue your biology degree or whatever you're doing. And if you're interested in media, that'll come in time. I think it's, and maybe even work in a different field, work out of journalism for a while, do something different, because it just gives you a breadth of knowledge, I think, that you can then draw upon in later life. And your mind changes, your philosophy and your interests change as you get older. So I think the more varied an experience that you have that isn't necessarily journalism is for the better. And I think that's the main advice that I would give people, is just be very open-minded to things.
Last question then, because I'm hugely interested in science as well. And do you think it's portrayed fairly in the mainstream news media in a kind of balanced way? Because some of the constraints are in the fact that, you know, the 10 o'clock news will have someone who says climate change is happening, this is real. But then in the interest of balance, they have to put someone else on. But that's presenting a kind of an imbalance, because most of the mainstream science supports man-made climate change. And I also think of the creationist debate in America, where they would say teach the debate, as if there was a debate, when in fact there isn't one.
It's, yeah, a fascinating area. And I think you still need to reflect all sides. I think something like climate change, where the vast body of opinion is that climate change is real, I think you need to, in terms of the weight of your coverage, you need to reflect that. And I don't necessarily think on something like that, that you need to give 50-50 time. Because I just don't think most, hesitate to use the word reasonable, but most reasonable people looking at the debate would think that it was equal in terms of those who are for and against that particular subject. So I think, you know, you need to give it the weight that most right-thinking people give it, I think, you know, looking across the board. That said, there are detractors and there are those who have a contrary view. I mean, look at Donald Trump, for example. He shrugs his shoulders and laughs when people talk about climate change to him. He doesn't see it as a big issue for the future. He thinks they're much bigger threats to humanity than climate change. And you've got to reflect that, and you've got to, you know, give due respect to people who have that argument. I mean, I hesitate on any issue to give my own personal opinion, but I think you can probably tell from what I'm saying what I think of that particular issue. But it doesn't mean to say that I can't be open-minded and look at the most extreme of arguments on the other side.
Peter, we've definitely run out of tape now. Thank you ever so much for your time. I've hugely enjoyed it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!